The Tragedy of Cinema podcast is intended as a family-friendly program that by extension strives to be inclusive to all people regardless of their ethnicity, gender, creed, or any other identifying factors in this incredibly diverse world of ours. With that said, some of the films we discuss may contain serious subject matters or have content considered morally objectionable by today's standards. We do not intend to condone or dismiss these aspects of these films, but our primary focus will be on what we believe the film succeeds at, some fun facts, and our personal enjoyment factors of each film. With that said, we hope you enjoy the show.
It's Spencer Tracy, as you've never seen him before, and Katharine Hepburn, as you've always wanted to see her. They'll have you rocking and rolling with laughter as they match wits with Miss Emmy, the machine that can replace everybody except a woman like Katie. Wow.
What are you thinking, Bunny?
Except for sex, what's left?
Meet the desk set, the girls and boys who make the office such a wonderful place to love in. Gig Young as the prize catch of the office. Joan Blondell, Dina Merrill, Sue Randall, Diane Jurgens, Mary Anders. See the kisses, the misses, the conquests, the coffee breaks, the love breaks, and those Christmas parties where everything goes and anything can happen.
I think perhaps I'd better put my clothes on. I left them in the bedroom.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bunny.
What do you think of all that guff I swallowed that cozy night at your apartment? For the love of Pete, I even apologized to you for that. And now this, I don't know what you're talking about routine. Look, Bunny, I don't know what kind of a game it is you're playing, but whatever it is, you've got the wrong boy.
Yeah, but not Bunny Watson. It would never work.
Why not?
Because you're not in love with me, you're in love with her. She'd always come first. Anything went wrong with her, you'd forget about me like that.
Oh, well, you don't know. I couldn't care less about that. It could blow up and it wouldn't bother me.
You've heard of the country club set, the station wagon set, the social set, but you ain't seen nothing till you've seen what goes on and on and on with the desk set.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Tragedy of Cinema podcast. I'm your host, Jimbo.
And I'm your co-host, Kyle.
And Kyle, tonight we are joined by special guest, Sarah Deedonitis. Sarah, how are you? And I hope I pronounced your last name right. It's been a minute since I had to say it.
Pretty close. It's a hard one, Deedonitis, but you did a great job. Hi, guys. And hi. So glad to be here tonight.
Right. So we're going to let the audience know how this came about. I'm at work one day and I get a ding on my phone and it's Sarah's like, hey, you remember me basically. And she said, have you guys done the movie Desk Set for the podcast yet? And I was like, nope. And she's like, well, you know, can we set something up where we can cover it? She's like, it's one of my favorite movies. I said, sure. So that's been a couple weeks ago. And finally, we have time to actually sit down and discuss one of Sarah's favorite movies. I've known Sarah, man, it's probably been about 4 years now, I would say. For those of you that have been a longtime listener of this podcast, you may remember I had a voice acting role in Hillbilly Horror House by Tim Mullins, where I played Danny. And Sarah was also in that, where she played the Evil Queen and also the little old lady that you weren't supposed to know about yet. But we had some good times doing that. And at the end of this, I'm going to give Sarah some time to tell what she's doing now with Tim Mullins. There's some pretty exciting stuff going on, some stuff that's out now, and then some stuff that's happening in the future. But without further ado, this is going to be a little different episode because I told Sarah, I said, Sarah, you're in charge of all the notes tonight. So I've only got something little at the beginning, and I can't wait because I've always been the one that prepares stuff hardcore. And this is kind of fun for me because I'm kind of, number one, I'm tired because I worked about 19 and a half hours last night. So, and got 2 hours of sleep. So I figured I better let Sarah take the reins because Jimbo might crash the buggy. So Kyle, why don't you go ahead and kick us off with Death Set?
All right. We have the movie Death Set released on Death Set. I got to get that K in there. I'm Kyle for Christ. Whatever. It's okay. Words are tough. Okay. Starting off right here. Okay. Death Set released on August 2nd, 1957. Directed by Walter Lang. Written by Phoebe Ephraim, Henry Ephraim, and William Marchant. And let's see here. Quick little story synopsis of the film. Film stars the Katharine Hepburn playing the role of Bunny Watson, who is a library reference clerk stuck in a dead-end relationship with a boring television executive. Her life is thrown into turmoil when a computer expert, Richard Simmons, played by Spencer Tracy, enters it.
Sumner.
Yeah, Richard Summers.
Hi, guys. We're sweating to the oldies. Ah! Amazing.
Yes. Spencer Tracy's character, Richard Summers, has been assigned with the automating her department, and she's fearful that Summers' new computers will automate her out of the job. She despises him at first, but eventually each of the two start to fall for each other's charms and strong personalities. Technical details of the film. This film has a runtime of 1 hour and 43 minutes. This is a color film. Sound mix is four track stereo. Aspect ratio is 2.35:1. And the country of origin this was filmed in was, of course, the United States of America. Moving on to the cast of the film, we have Spencer Tracy playing the role of Richard Sumner. Richard Sumner, Spencer Tracy was also in such amazing films such as Judgment at Nuremberg, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and Inherit the Wind. And then we have Katharine Hepburn playing the role of Bunny Watson. Katharine Hepburn was also in the films such as The Lion in Winter, The Philadelphia Story, and Old Galton Pond. Then we have Gig Young playing the role of Mike Cutler. Gig Young was also in such films such as They Shoot Horses, Teacher's Pet, and The Touch of Mink. Then we have Joanne Fondale. What's that?
You ever seen Touch of Mink?
No, I've never have. Is it a good movie?
It's a good movie.
It's a good movie.
Have you seen Touch of Mink?
No, I have not.
No?
I've never heard of it until now.
What year did it come out?
That's a good question. I'll look it up real quick.
I can't remember if the female lead in that is either... I don't want to
say... Audrey Meadows. Came out in... Oh, or it's a Doris Day.
Doris Day. Grandpa's favorite lady.
Yeah.
Yes, Doris Day, man. Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. Yeah, mm-hmm. And it came out in 1962.
Okay. So just after this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, next up we have Joanne Blondell playing the role of Peg Costello. Joanne Blondell was also in the films Grease in 1978, The Cincinnati Kid in 1965, and Opening Night in 1977. Then next up, we have Dinah Morrell playing the role of Sylvia Blair. Dinah Morrell was also in such films such as Butterfield 8 in 1960, Operation Petticoat in 1959, and The Player in 1992. Cool there. Then next up, we have Sue Randell playing the role of Ruthie Saylor. Ruthie Saylor was also in such films such as, I got a text there at second last second. I got a sound on my phone. But she was also in such roles as The Twilight Zone, where she was in the episode Millie, where she played the role of a nurse in sometime between 1959 and 1964. Didn't say which year that episode came out. I'll try to reduce that, Jimbo. And episode of Leave It to Beaver and episode of Playhouse 90. Next up, we have Neva Patterson playing the role of Miss Warner. War Reiner. Nisa was also in the movie films All the President's Men, David and Lisa, and An Affair to Remember. Then next up, we have Harry Ellenberg playing the role of Smithers. Harry Ellenberg was also in such films such as House of Usher in 1960, The Outer Limits episode, one episode in 1963, where he played the role of Doctor, and in the show One Step Beyond in 1960. Then we have Nicholas Joy playing the role of Mr. Azay. Mr. Nicholas Joy was also in such films such as New One in 1941 as a writer for the film, Joan of Arc in 1948, and Native Son in 1951. And then we have the role of Diana Alice, played by Diane Jurgens. Diane Jurgens was also in such films such as Escape to Paradise in 1960, High School Confidential in 1958, and Island of the Lost Women in 1959. And then finally, we're going to go on to, I lost my place here. Mary Anders. Mary Anders playing the role of Kathy. Mary Anders also appeared in such films such as Tickle Me in 1965, The Dolphin Girls in 1957, and Young Jesse James in 1960. And that concludes the cast of Death Set.
So, Kyle, you ever seen Tickle Me?
I've never seen Tickle Me.
No.
That is Elvis Presley, baby.
Oh.
Oh.
Check out that then.
Right.
Always a sucker for a good Elvis Presley film, for sure.
I've probably seen it.
Oh, yeah. So before I hand over the reins to Sarah for the rest of the show.
no pressure.
You'll be fine. I went through and I was like, well, what can I add? I'm kind of out of it tonight, but I wanted to, participate. So I was like, you always hear about Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, one of the most iconic duos in filmmaking. But their history together is something pretty interesting, too. I read the autobiography Me by Katharine Hepburn. If anybody's a fan of hers, I suggest you go find it. I found mine at Half Price Books for about $7.99. But here we go. This is from a blog on Discord walks.com. It was written by Vanessa M on February 16th of 2024, so just recently. And this is 20 facts about Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy's relationship. Their love affair spanned 27 years, first and foremost. So here we go. Number one, Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy first met on the set of the 1942 film Woman of the Year. So that was the very first time that the two had worked together and the first time they met. And the director thought that they brought some pretty good energy together. So the chemistry of them was palpable, and it defined their on-screen characters. Number two, at the time of their meeting, Tracy was married to Louis Treadwell. That's another podcast. But the clandestine affair between Hepburn and Tracy took place during the glitz of Hollywood's golden age against the backdrop of Tracy's marriage to Louise Treadwell. Despite societal constraints and Tracy's devotion to his wife, an undeniable bond developed on the set of Woman of the Year in 1942. Their secret love transcended convention. The clandestine romance unfolded quietly away from prying eyes of the public and scrutiny of an era less tolerant of unconventional relationships. Their unspoken bond grew despite the odds, laying the groundwork for a love story that would reverberate through the halls of Hollywood history. Number three, the on-screen chemistry between Hepburn and Tracy was undeniable. I mean, you can even see it in this movie we're getting ready to talk about. They just act so well together in this movie, too. The banter, I think it was in Woman of the Year where they banter back and forth. And then when they were in the comedic, Adam's Rib, I think is the one I watched. Yeah. And then Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. They won support for that, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. But it's like they did it effortlessly, So number four, despite their prominent careers, they were extremely private about their personal life. Like I said, I read this book. She's very respectable of Spencer Tracy in this book, and she doesn't dive into any of their romance stuff and everything. So I thought that was a very nice gesture of her. But once we get going into this, you'll see some other stuff that happened. So number five, Tracy's strong Catholic faith played a role in his decision not to divorce his wife. Mm-hmm. So his unwavering Catholic faith influenced his decision to remain married to Louise Treadwell despite his strong feelings for Katharine Hepburn. His strong belief in the sanctity of marriage aligned with Catholic teachings, rendering divorce incompatible with his faith. The ethical quandary of choosing between personal happiness and religious principles influenced Tracy's love life. His unwavering devotion to Catholicism influenced not only his personal choices, but also highlighted the intricate interplay between faith and matters of the heart, adding to the Hepburn Tracy's romance and dynamics of their relationship. Number six, their secret affair lasted until Tracy died in 1967. Despite Tracy's marriage to Louise Treadwell and societal norms at the time, their love grew over 25 years hidden from public view. This covert romance overcame Tracy's health issues, including alcoholism, as well as the couple's determination to live separate public lives. The strength of their hidden connection demonstrated the tenacity of a love story that transcended Hollywood glamour, leaving an indelible mark on cinematic history. Number seven, Hepburn and Tracy appeared in 9 films together. So here's some of them. Adam's Rib, we talked about. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Death Set, Woman of the Year, Pat and Mike. So as they went along, they just loved working together. Because I think, now this is my own personal thing I'm throwing in here, I think because they were on the set together, they got to spend more time together because they lived separate lives. So why wouldn't you want to stay there with, you know, your love interest? Number eight, even though they lived together, Tracy always returned home to his wife Louise after filming was completed. Despite their strong bond and cohabitation during filming breaks, Spencer Tracy remained committed to maintaining a sense of domestic normalcy by returning to his wife after each project was completed. Tracy and Hepburn's unconventional living arrangements allowed them to share moments on and off set, but Tracy's devotion to his marital vows drew him back to Louise. This intricate dance between personal commitments and a secret love affair added to the enigmatic allure of Hepburn and Tracy's relationship, emphasizing the complexities and sacrifices woven into the fabric of their long-lasting and discreet romance. Number nine, both Hepburn and Tracy both received Academy Awards for their roles in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. That's an outstanding movie. If you have not seen this movie, it talks about interracial relationships. And I do believe, isn't that a Sidney Poitier?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Sidney Poitier.
But Spencer Tracy's health deteriorated during the production of this movie, and he died just 17 days after the filming ended. The film's bittersweet success added an emotional layer to their final collaboration, and Tracy's posthumous Academy Award is a testament to his enduring talent and the profound impact of their final cinematic collaboration. Tracy's death marked the end of a remarkable period in Hollywood. Tracy and Hepburn were both well known for their strong work ethic, not only on their on-screen chemistry, but their unwavering work ethic. They were always consummate professionals, approaching their craft with dedication and precision. The duo's dedication was excellent. And it was clear that their extensive rehearsal sessions where they meticulously fine-tuned their performances. Number 11, their contrasting characteristics appeared to complement one another. I mean, let's face it. You see Spencer Tracy in this movie and you see Katharine Hepburn and you're like, they just look funny together, I think. You know, yes. They're totally opposite. He's like a goofy old man, hilarious guy. And she's like a snobby rich woman. But I think that's what it worked. So... number 12, yeah. Hepburn discussed her relationship with the Tracy in her autobiography, Me, Stories of My Life, which I have a copy right here in front of me. It provided insight into her extraordinary life while remaining discreet about her relationship with Spencer Tracy. While the book focused on her career, personal struggles, and reflections, Hepburn treated Tracy with respect. She chose not to reveal intimate details to honor Tracy's memory and their mutual commitment to privacy. Her restraint reflected not only her deep admiration for Tracy, but also the enduring loyalty that defined their 27-year relationship, reinforcing the ideals that some chapters of love are best preserved in the privacy of personal memories. Number 13, Hepburn was fiercely loyal to Tracy. You read her story about that, and you read some other stuff, but she was so compassionate towards him. And understanding of him, which endured their bond by helping him overcome her demons with resilience and love. Number 14, now this is going to be a rough one. Be prepared, Sarah. Hepburn claimed that she stole one of Tracy's shirts before he died and slept with it all of her life.
Oh my gosh.
Hepburn shared a touching memento of her enduring love for Tracy, revealing that she took one of his shirts before his death and slept with it all of her life. This intimate act provided Tracy with a tangible connection, comforting her and serving as a reminder of their deep bond.
I find that very wonderful, actually. Quite the testament.
Her admission highlighted his profound impact on her life, demonstrating the strength of their bond even after his death. The stolen shirt became a treasured relic, a symbol of their enduring love that transcended their private world and reverberated through the halls of Hollywood history. Number 15, to prevent speculation and gossip, the couple avoided attending public events together. So they were totally committed to living separate lives.
It was the illusion that they have, oh no, they're just two actors. No connection.
Right. So it did allow them, you got to remember, this is back when there were no cell phones and all that stuff. So they could get away with a lot more than they could now. Number 16, throughout the relationship, Hepburn and Tracy shared a deep mutual respect for one another. And you could tell that with their on-screen chemistry. There's one scene in this movie I think that's really funny. And I know it, I probably didn't even mean to happen, but when he goes and gets caught in the rain and they go upstairs, and he goes, you know, he gets dressed back from the robe and he goes to leave. And then he comes back with a shirt untucked and this thing. And she just about falls out of the chair dying laughing. I don't know if that was scripted because that's pretty funny. And
no, it was not actually.
See, look at that. I could tell because the way she almost fell out of the chair and laughed, that's right. Just something he would do.
Right.
After Tracy's death, love letters between him and Hepburn were discovered. So following his death, I discovered the love letters between him and Hepburn surfaced, revealing the depth of their emotions and the enduring nature of their bond. These intimate letters offered a rare glimpse into their private lives, demonstrating the passion and profound affection that defined their 27-year relationship. I don't know if they're written down anywhere or you can find them. I'm sure you probably can. The correspondence, though, which was kept private for years, served as a testament to the unspoken poetry that threaded through their enduring love story, shedding light on the sentiments that transcended the screen and provided a poignant, posthumous reflection of the extraordinary bond they shared. The film starring, or number 18, the film starring Hepburn and Tracy are still remembered for their wit, charm, and undeniable chemistry. If you watch the, here we go right here, in Death Set 1957, sparks fly against a comedic backdrop of workplace challenges. Decades later, these films are still cherished for the magnetic chemistry between Hepburn and Tracy, demonstrating the enduring appeal on their on-screen partnership and the cultural resonance of their cinematic collaboration. Number 19, Hepburn never had her children, but became a surrogate mother for Tracy's son. Despite never having children of her own, Hepburn became a surrogate mother to Tracy's son, John Tracy. Recognizing the complexities of Tracy's personal life, Hepburn provided maternal care to John, forming a close bond with him. Her involvement in his life demonstrated the depth of her commitment to Tracy and his family. Hepburn's nurturing presence provided stability for John, demonstrating her ability to navigate Tracy's complex personal dynamics with grace and love, reinforcing the unique, enduring nature of her relationship with both father and son. And this one breaks my heart right here. But number 20, Hepburn did not attend Tracy's funeral because of respect for his family. So Hepburn did not attend Tracy's funeral, choosing to respect his family's wishes and remain private in her grief. Despite their deep personal connection, she kept a low profile during this difficult time, preferring not to overshadow Tracy's family's mourning. Her absence from Tracy's funeral demonstrated her deep understanding of the complexities of Tracy's personal life, as well as the importance of maintaining privacy, even in the face of a profound loss. This decision reflected Tracy's commitment to navigating the complex dynamics of the relationship with grace and respect for their closest to her. Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy's love story is woven into the fabric of Hollywood romance like a thread. Their enduring love, marked by secrecy, loyalty, and undeniable chemistry, created cinematic magic that will last. Despite societal constraints and Tracy's unwavering marriage, their story demonstrated love's resilience. Hepburn's poignant words, combined with Tracy's lasting impact, creates a portrait of a one-of-a-kind connection that, even after decades, continues to captivate hearts and define the timeless allure of Hollywood's golden age. So that was just things that I found. And this blog that Vanessa M. wrote on this website, I thought it was pretty interesting, and I thought I'd share it with you guys just so you could tell a little bit more of their chemistry on screen and off screen. So
it's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm.
All right, Sarah, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you so much, guys, for having me on tonight. I truly appreciate it. This is definitely my favorite movie. And, you know, I feel like I'm going to fail against your typical facts and interesting tidbits, but I'll do my best.
Hey, sometimes change is good.
Yeah. Desk Set is a movie that's near and dear to my heart. When I living nearby Detroit, we're able to tap into TV from Canada. So one night I wasn't sleeping in my condo, turned on the TV and found this movie and could not get back to sleep till it was done. And it's what, hour and 46 minutes, was just captivating. And I found each and every character brought something to the plate. It was not one character kind of led the whole thing. Everybody had this delicate dance, and it was just a wonderful movie. And I love it. I watch it regularly. Again, last night, just to make sure I was fully prepared for this evening. I do have a couple cast members that were not mentioned. First of all, being a older woman that kind of was seen throughout the whole movie, and her real name is Ida Moore, and she was literally listed as old lady in the credits. She actually represented the, there was a statue in front of the building, and it was built after her in her younger days. So
isn't there a portrait of her hanging in the reference room too, I do believe.
Yes. Yes, there is. It's right by the door. And she was pointed out when Spencer did not know why she was existing there. So the other one is the great and wonderful Philodendron, which is what sparked me to contact you, James, is because I have such a Philodendron actually growing out of my fish tank, because the roots help the fish tank stay clean. And it's now, I keep cutting it back, but it's now growing across our fireplace mantle, which sent me into a tailspin of trying to find little clips of videos to show my girls about the Philodendron in this amazing movie. So what happened is, when Catherine came onto set, she walked into what would be her office, and on the desk sat this small diminutive plant. And she not so very calmly stated, "What is this?" And they're like, "We believe it's a Philodendron." They even went and got the stage manager to calm down and confirm that, yes, it was a Philodendron. And she goes, "That just will not do." So she went back to her home and brought back the Philodendron in the movie, which literally starts on a desk on the wall, the far wall, to the right of the screen, goes up to the ceiling and around her office. And it actually is front and center in the scene right in the beginning, when Tracy comes up, and I'll actually start calling them from their characters, when Richard Sumner comes up into the office for the first time, and it's a vacated office. Bonnie hasn't made it up there yet, and he actually stops and touches the Philodendron in disbelief that this is a real plant. And for true, it was. She insisted upon it. To say that the woman had a green thumb is just a, you know,
understatement.
Thank you. It's late. words are hard. I'll borrow Kyle's line. Okay, just a few interesting tidbits. A few interesting tidbits here. This is the third movie that Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn starred in together. They have 9 altogether. So from my research, they kept saying 8. So I'm assuming they're meaning 8 other ones. Like Die Hard, Desk Set is a hotly contested movie amongst fans, because it has a very poignant Christmas section in it. Whether you stay on the Die Hard Christmas movie or not, I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings, but I don't watch it at Christmas time. That this also has that, because it's got a good section in the middle of the movie that revolves around a Christmas theme. The movie Death Set was released in the UK under the title His Other Woman, meaning Amarak, the other computer. Well, and you know what? That is it. That is
very
on words, isn't it? It's got a little double entendre there. Because of the fact that Amarak, the computer, was his first love. Shirley Booth, who played the role of Bunny Watson in the stage play, was slated to actually be Bunny Watson in the movie. But when she met Spencer Tracy, they did not hit it off, to put it lightly. The outside filming of the movie were of the RCA, or now Comcast, building, 30 Rockefeller Plaza, and NBC headquarters. And those clips were actually used as being what the building they were working in was. This movie took place in, obviously, the 1950s when computers were just starting to come on the scene. So it kind of played off that fear, but it really gave you a look into what offices were like, especially corporate, large corporate offices. Okay, in the beginning of the movie, I'm going to pull it up because I took a picture of it while watching the movie. And this goes to prove kind of where the film was going. It literally states, "We gratefully acknowledge the cooperation and assistance of the International Business Machines Corporation." So they kind of gave a nod to the up and coming
IBM.
Yes, yes. And they utilized IBM in the movie as well, because Bunny had gone to IBM training the morning that the beginning scenes took place. There is a goof in the film. The scene where Mike gives Bunny, so Mike is the quote-unquote boyfriend, gives Bunny white carnations. She places one in his lapel. Later in the movie, in that part of the day, she takes the white flowers home. And she brings them into the elevator as white. They did have a little bit of pink inside in that scene. But when she comes out of the elevator, they are dark pink carnations. So I don't know if that was just an oversight or maybe a nod to somebody, you know, like the Carol Burnett thing.
Huh? Is that also where she leaves the flowers in the car and the one guy thinks, "Oh, son, you got me flowers."
Yes. It was the mother coming in from was it Chattahoochee, Tennessee? No.
Chattanooga.
Chattanooga, thank you. Yeah, the mother was coming in Chattanooga to celebrate Smithers' family, the holidays. Good memory there, sir. There is a Canadian radio program called Bunny Watson, and that was named after the movie's character. Corporate culture of the 1950s was definitely at play here. I want to give you a couple reviews, because we were chit-chatting about that a bit before we started recording, and we did not discuss anything feelings one way or another really before we started recording. So we're all going to share that at the end. Well, I think you already know where I stand, but anyway, Time magazine at the time the movie was rolled out wrote, quote, "At long last, somebody has a kind word for the girls in the research department. The word, one of those electronic brains could do the job much better with less back chat. And what's more, it would be free the girls. Energies for the more important job of getting a man, desk set has been expanded from the play by a sizable pigeonhole in which Hepburn and Tracy intermittently bill and coo. Oh, on the whole, forgive me, I know how to read. On the whole, the film compares favorably with the play. And though actress Hepburn tends to wallow in the wake of Shirley Booth, she never quite sinks to the comic scenes. And in the romantic ones, she is light enough to ride the champagne splashes of emotion as she were going over Niagara in a barrel. Spencer Tracy has one wonderful slapstick scene. The gig young ones very well with the comic style for which he is much beholden to William Holden." The Philadelphia Inquirer did not quite like it as much as the Time magazine did. Do you want me to read that one? I don't have to, guys.
Sure, go for it. Whatever you want.
Okay. One of you might understand it. They were critical. This, again, is the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they said, "The middle-aged excesses of Miss Hepburn and Tracy leave a good deal to be desired. Equipped with an insatiable vehicle, bogged down by surprisingly flat-footed direction, the stars come close to being embarrassing as they bound through roles involving them in office nonsense about a mechanical brain. A bibulous Christmas party, an innocent but suspecting dinner in negligee Katie's rainbound flat, merchant's foolish little comedy gains, nothing via the Phoebe and Henry Efron adaptation. Long recitations from Hiawatha and the curfew shall not ring tonight, plus question and answer games, in addition to the repetitious of the central idea, turn desk sets 104 minutes into an endurance contest for cast and audience." Wow, burn.
That
burn,
sounds
burn.
Like a Kyle review right there.
My Lord.
I don't know if I'd be so cruel.
However, well written and a beautiful play on words, still, still, I loved the curfew shall not ring tonight section of the movie. That was just, it was phenomenal. So, gents, shall we get into it?
Absolutely.
The movie opens up where Richard Sumner, who kind of comes off in the beginning as this bumbling idiot, wanders into the corporate offices of this company and says that he wants to meet with the CEO. And the secretary says, well, wait a minute. Today, you're not supposed to meet with him till tomorrow. And he goes, oh, is it Monday? And she goes, no, it's Tuesday. And you're supposed to meet with him on Wednesday. So he finds his way up to the resource office, and he finds it inhabited by the first three characters, who are brilliant in their own right. They are, forgive me, Joan Blondell, who plays Peg, Diana Merrill, who plays Sylvia, and Sue Randall. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, who plays Ruthie. They are just brilliant and bright and really bring a good grounding to the whole movie. Sumner walks in and they are just curiously watching him. And throughout this whole movie, the phone constantly rings. And there's a lot of kind of drops of comments of let's go places where the phone's not ringing. And when the phone rings, these women answer and they go and find out whatever reference or information the caller is looking for. This just really plays to Catherine's brilliance and her ability to handle herself in stressful situations. Because just watching them banter back and forth, the whole cast, especially in this department, kind of gives you a understanding of not only are they're memorizing the script, but they have to pull it off in such a casual way. And they they all do it so well.
It's a very demanding scene.
Well, oh my gosh, it is.
Here's the thing I had with that. When it first started up and the one lady answers the phone and she's like, well, I'll have to order that again tomorrow. And the other is like, hey, what's the greatest baseball team of all time, a score of the Dodgers game or whatever? And I'm like, are these ladies just basically, I thought the movie was going to go to where these ladies are just wasting time. He's going to come in and see they're wasting time. And that's going to be part of the reduction. But as the movie progressed, you actually find out that people are calling them and asking them because they are a reference center. Like if you go to the library, Kyle, when me and Sarah were younger and we would go to the library, we actually had the reference cards you had to go dig out or have the librarian dig out for you. And it would tell you where it had to go find it in the library. It was like a search thing. And you see a little bit of that here towards the end of this movie where Catherine Hepburn tells her, hey, go back there to the back and this book at the bottom left-hand side of the shelf, grab it and to beat the computer. So for me, when it first started, I was really confused. So if people watch this, just make sure that you know that those three ladies are in a reference center. And you see the lady that that's basically the building's named after or whatever. You see her come in when Spencer Tracy's there and she just goes up, picks a book, and then she comes over, flips the card on the table and just walks back out. And he's like, hey, who is this lady? He's like, oh, you don't know. That's her hanging on the wall. Mm-hmm. So the way I would take it is these ladies are like librarians, just a wealth of knowledge. And Catherine Hepburn is their boss of that department is what people need to realize when they watch this. So,
but they're like those librarians. By the way, side note, thank God for Google. Anyway, not necessary to go to the library anymore. Wait. Although
did you ever have the encyclopedia salesman come to your front door to try to sell you a whole set of Encyclopedia Britannicas?
No, I've had Hoover vacuum salesman, but I've never had an encyclopedia salesman before.
Do you remember those, Sarah?
We had encyclopedias, a full set. Side note, I was helping my school. I started with a new Christian school back in the day, and I used to watch Laughing.
Oh, yeah.
And they would always say, look it up in your Funkin' Wagnalls. And I always just chuckled about it, but I never realized. And then one day the librarian's like, open up this box and put those away. And I opened the box and it was a box of Funkin' Wagnalls encyclopedias. And I laughed. That was great. So anyway, wow. Okay. Yeah. That was,
terrible with a list, but amazing.
And the thing is, in the movie, what I think they're setting up, and I agree with you, James, is they're trying to set up the brilliance of these women. And especially the one when, the first call that comes in, who was the best player of all time, which was Ty Cobb, which is a distant relative of mine. So thank you very much. Really? And he played only for the Detroit Tigers for 21 years. I'm sure he's lost his record Poor since guy. 1957. Hey. I watched the game. This afternoon. Shots fired.
Well, it could have been worse. She could have said he played for the Yankees, right?
Okay. Yeah, I'll agree with that. So, but then as this is going on, you have Richard Sumner just silently measuring the office. And as these women finish with their phone calls, they all just kind of stop and stare as a group, just what is he doing? And so he asks them to help and no answers. But of course, office rumors are overwhelming. And after Sumner left the main office of the CEO, a phone call was being made to the reference department that some guy's coming. So in walks Bunny Watson with a big box. Now, Sumner is in her office observing the philodendron, and Bunny Watson comes in with a big box. Well, she had worked at the office till 10 o'clock the night before, and she had a meeting at IBM looking at this new big brain and stopped off at the store to buy a dress. And they take the box from her and whisk her into the office saying, "You've been in meetings all day." And she meets with Sumner, and the brilliance begins right there, because he introduces himself and she goes, "Well, you must be a good man of some stature because you have 13 letters in your name." And so you're like, "Oh, okay, sit back. You're going to have to take it in. This is going to happen." And that just starts this intelligent banter back and forth. He was informed by the CEO not to tell the girls in the office what he was doing. Later in the movie, at the very, very end of the movie, it was revealed why. But at first, you know, one would get offended as to what you don't think they could handle it. So this whole time it's been rumor and feelings and things. And so a little later in the day, Sumner comes in the office and asks Bunny for lunch. She agrees. At this point, Mike comes in, which is he's not really a boyfriend. He is head of her department, so it's her boss. And, you know, handsome, carries himself, dresses well. But we find out very quickly, uses her as his plus one when there's not another plus one to be found.
She's a lady of convenience for him.
Right. And Peg pegs it, you know, and she calls her out on it constantly throughout the movie that she needs to let him go. And she's enamored with him. And she's, you know, held on for 7 years waiting for this marriage proposal to come. And he's haphazardly always making, you know, excuses as to not fulfill whatever promise he has. So she had gone to the store to buy a dress for some dance, some ball. And he came and he asked her. And so she showed him the dress, and then he leaves behind her office. There's a door that escapes behind her office that has a private elevator. And then Sumner comes in stage left. And they start discussing, and he asked her to lunch. So they go in and do some more work on the answering of phones. Sumner comes in extremely late for lunch, and she goes up. They go to the elevator, and she expects to go down, and he tells them to go up. And they decide to have lunch outside on a balcony, like on the 31st floor at this high rise in the wintertime. So she's freezing, and he's, you know, he brings out all the food and they're eating, and he starts asking her this intelligence test, which I agree with the review that it was just kind of like, really? But it kind of added to the play and added to her intelligence and kind of, you know, kind of set the scene of
right. Because especially
the dangerousness,
especially when he's like, "I want to ask you a question." And you're like, "Okay, what's this going to be?" You know? And he's like, "You know, if a train's leaving at this time with three people on it and another train leaves here, you know, it's just this big old thing." And he's like, "What time does it arrive?" or whatever. And she did, right. "Well, how did you get that?" And, you know, because she's very sharp. Her brain is on a whole nother.
Yes.
And he's like, "Huh." And then is this also where she says, and you know, I assume you live alone because, you know, you're wearing two different color socks too.
Yes.
That's how observant she is.
Right. She's showing her observation skills. She's showing her intelligence, but she's not overtly so. Like, she, like a lot of very intelligent people I know, they don't want to push it in your face. She didn't do that. And it was, he had to draw it out of her. She pointed out his socks, and that comes into play later in the movie. So time goes by. There's a lot of rumor. There's another character that comes into play, and it's Smithers. he actually is from the legal department, which is across the hallway from the reference department. And he's the one that kind of takes in the rumors and runs with them. It's just interesting to see this, you know, kind of cast of characters play together. So let me see. Where do we want to go next, guys?
I think this is where
the rain scene.
The rain scene. Because she's closing up for the night, and right. She turns out the lights and everything. Goes over and all she says,
in the elevator.
Out of here.
Yeah. She's shocked.
Stuck in the thing. So so she has her flowers with her. They walk out down the elevator. And it is pouring down the rain.
Yes.
They get out there, and Smithers is out there. His mom's pulled up with a car.
Well, no. She's talking with Smithers in the hallway outside of her office for a minute. And then he comes out. So she's carrying luggage because she was supposed to go on a trip with her boo. And he came in and had to cancel because he had to take a last minute flight with the CEO. So Sumner takes... Sumner takes the big luggage to help her. She's got her little luggage and her flowers. Smithers is there, and they go in the elevator together. And nobody's really saying anything, and everybody's kind of uncomfortable. When they come out, Sumner says something to Bunny about, should we do this? And she's like, why not? It's going to be in the office. Chat anyways, come tomorrow. So they go out, it's pouring rain, like you said. Smithers are like, don't worry, my wife's gonna be fine with you getting in the car. Well, there's like two kids, a dog, a mother-in-law in the front seat, the wife's driving, it's pouring rain. Obviously it's the 50s, there's no air conditioning in the car, so the windows are cracked, just miserable. They finally get everybody in the car, and because Smithers like, you're not gonna mind taking my friends from work home, right? You know. So they get out of the car, and Bunny and Sumner run up the stairs to her brownstone. It was an apartment building, but it was built like a brownstone. Mm-hmm. And they're underneath the ledge, and she's like, "Well, do you want to go home?" And you know, well, or do you, he says, "Do you want me to go home?" And she's like, "No, you know, whatever. Come on up." And so they get to her apartment. Beautiful apartment, by the way. My goodness. Anyways,
yeah.
And she's like, "Hey, I shop early." And you know, you got to get out of those wet clothes. So she goes and searches through her gifts and finds her boyfriend's robe that with she monogrammed
on there.
She monogrammed him herself on the robe. And so she's like, just don't get it wet. And she hands it to him, and he goes into the bedroom. She's in the main room, but there's a closet there, and she changes her clothes into a robe as well. And a little miscommunication about what they're going to have for dinner. And then Sumner offers to fry her up some chicken, goulash or chicken. Right. And she said something about does he want to borrow her goulashes? And he took it as goulash for dinner. So anyway, he went in the kitchen to make fried chicken for them. And then cut scene. They come back. They've already eaten. Go ahead.
But you remember, he comes out of the bathroom before she gets done, and he puts his wet shoes in the oven.
In the oven, which does come into play later. Yeah. So they're sitting there, and they're, you know, obviously after a good conversation, some good chicken, and she compliments him on it. And then the doorbell rings. They talk about dessert, and the doorbell rings. And she's like, well, for God's sakes, you know, nobody comes and visits me. And she gets the door, and it's Mike, the boyfriend. And she's acting funny. He doesn't know why. And he comes in, and there's Sumner. Now, mind you, there's some bad blood between the two men from the get-go of this movie. And that bad blood comes into play. Now, it really gets pretty heated between the three of them, because Mike is assuming that her and Sumner are having a tryst, which in real life they are. and, you know, he's trying to explain, no, I was just wet. And she's trying to keep it going. Like, yeah, they are having a tryst to maybe make Mike feel something. And it just, the voices get raised and everybody talks over one another. And then finally, I forget exactly what happened, where it just, I think she outshouts everybody and just calms everybody down. And she had mentioned a few times throughout dinner and then after Mike had gotten there about the smell in the house of something burning. And even Mike brings it up and she's like, oh no, I just need to change my vent, which is what Summoner told her needed to happen. So they bring out, Summoner brings out dessert and coffee. They pour Mike coffee as well. And Mike feels like the third wheel he should feel like. And he leaves in a huff. Before that, it comes to point to fact that Sumner's wearing Mike's Christmas gift.
Yes.
And Sumner stands up and literally does a slow spin in which to show Mike his future gift, which I thought was a beautiful burn, very intelligent ad. And then there came a moment where the doorbell rings again. So now the two guys are there. Bunny's there. Things have already gotten heated and the doorbell rings. So Bunny goes and gets the door and it is Peg from the office. And Peg comes around and admittedly shocked about the whole deal. Mike leaves. And
him and Mike and Bunny actually make up here. Remember they go, she's eating the pie. He says, Peg, do you mind? Give us a moment. And he comes up like, look, you know, I'm sorry, overreacted or whatever. And he pulls her in a hug or whatever.
He pulled her in, but her arms remained behind her back. So his arm was around her waist, but her arms remained outside of his. Yes, you're right. And then he leaves. Peg comes in and she's shocked, obviously, to see Sumner in a robe. He goes back to get dressed and comes back out. Peg had gone in the kitchen for a minute to give Bunny and Mike some time while Sumner was getting changed. But Peg comes out holding the smoking shoes after Mike had left. And Sumner and everybody started laughing, and he tried to put the very hot now shoes on his feet. Then he goes out and around the corner. Now, this was a completely unscripted section of the film. He takes his hat, which was a fedora type hat that he wore pretty much throughout the film on and off, and he pulled it down over his eyes, pulled his shirt out of his pants, and looking completely disheveled, like saunters around the wall like he's completely drunk, which was met with uproarious laughter between Peg and Kate, Bunny, and they almost fall out of the chair, like James mentioned. It was a great, and the thing was, I didn't know that all the times I've watched it. So last night when I rewatched it, I really paid attention to the carnations and then also to the scene. And boy, was that, you know,
now you know, wonderful. It's where they're really breaking and having a fun time.
I mean, you could tell Katharine Hepburn broke, and so did Peg. They both just absolutely lost it.
They did. So the next scene is Christmas. And the office is decked. Everything's gorgeous. Everybody walks into cast drunk. I mean, drunk. There's champagne bottles being popped by Bunny. Everybody's drunk. The girls are having a great time. In walks Sumner to the main office. Actually, the reference office. And he calls down to the CEO office. And the secretary, drunk, answers the phone and says, you know, things aren't right here, what's going on? And she's like, you know, things are, you know, it's the day or whatever, and she keeps hiccuping. And then he goes, you know, you with the hiccups, you should probably have something to drink for that. And she goes, well, okay, hiccup. And then she hangs up the phone.
You insist, how about that?
Yeah, if you insist, right. So, you know, he's just watching all of this unfold. The girls, the Smithers comes in and says party started in the legal office. So they all run off into legal, leaving Sumner alone. And then Bunny comes back and they have a little conversation, and Sumner goes to leave the office, and she goes in her office for a minute, and there's Mike. He brings her up a Christmas gift of a large bunny, and he unzips the back, and it's a very large bottle of champagne enclosed. So that was her Christmas gift from him. One of them.
Hey, did you happen to notice what she says? She says, "Are you going to introduce me to Harvey?" Harvey was the name of the bunny rabbit that was with Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, right.
Do you remember that movie, Harvey? Where he had the,
no.
The imaginary bunny rabbit friend, Jimmy Stewart. It's a movie.
No.
Yeah, it came out just a few years prior, I believe. So.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a little. Cool. I think that's a subtle nod. I think it came out right before this, right, Kyle? If I remember right.
Hanging up right now.
But I also think doesn't she give Sumner his gift first before Mike walks in? Because he has.
Yes, she does.
Yeah, he
yes,
has.
She does.
She's knitted him
the scarf
of his.
She found it. Nope, she found it because she says that there was not much. There was not much demand for those colors. Maybe it was she knitted it and she was looking for those colors, but she said there was not much demand for those colors, so it was hard to find.
Well, it kind of looked like Ohio State's colors.
Yeah. Harvey came out in 1950, just 7 years prior.
7 years prior. Yeah.
So I think that's a slight nod. I'm not sure, but that's the only Harvey I know that was a rabbit. So
interesting. I heard her mumble something, but I couldn't make it out. That's interesting. Okay, cool. So yeah, she did give Sumner his gift. The large, it was a very long, like 6 foot long, scarf. And then they go into the office and then she gives Mike his gift. He gives her his, the gift that she gave him. She said, he goes, "I hope it's not a robe." She goes, it's as far away from a robe as I could get. And the sign above this gift said, "The gift to give the person who has everything," and it's bongos. And then he gives her earrings, and the party continues. And all of a sudden, the legal department party pours into her office, and they're even bringing a person ruckusly playing Christmas songs on a piano, rolling them in at the same time. Beautiful scene, very well laid out. The cinematography in this was wonderful because it just kind of brought you in. I really enjoyed the movie that way. She comes out, and even though a Christmas song is playing, she starts singing Night and Day. Or Day and Night, you were the one. Then they go upstairs. Her and Sumner go upstairs, and they're sitting up in the, there's this two-story library. And the second story kind of cuts back. So you've got a big vestibule where the offices are and then two stories in the back. So she goes up to the back and they're sitting together with, he's got champagne. He's now a few sheets under the wind himself. And she's right, holding a glass.
She's been giving him, because when they were down there, it was just her and Peg and him. They said, yes. "Hey, do you want some?" They started drinking. And then him and her went up the stairs and he's like, "Well," they act like they were on this big ship. And he's like, "Well, yes. This is my ship. I'm the captain."
Yes.
Kind of remind me of a little bit of a Titanic moment, you know?
Yes.
Like, I'm flying.
Yes. She's like, "Bon voyage." Yeah.
Right. And so, but I think this next little bit,
this scene
really
is poignant.
Captivates the essence of the movie, because you actually find out a little bit about Sumner's past.
Right.
Because she point blank asks him, she's like, "Well, are you married?" And he's like, "No," she said. "Do you like girls?"
Yeah.
Like, "Well, yeah."
Right. Right.
She's like, "But you don't like girls." She said, "No." He said, "Except for I think her name was it Carolyn or Caroline."
I believe so. Yes, Caroline. Yes.
Yeah.
And I think as far as about an hour into the film now, but I think like this is the point of the film where I think Richard Sumner actually finally realized that he actually is infatuated with Bunny as a character, as a person he actually admires. I don't think previous scenes he's more like he's intrigued. But I think in this is the scene where I think he actually believes he's in love with her.
His happened when he was in the at her apartment. I think that's when he first realized. I think this is where she realizes that she's into him, because he tells about, he's like, "Well, what happened?" And he's like, "Well, I was over there serving my country you know, and I'm, she's like, oh, you got a Dear John letter? He's like, oh, no. He's like, I got several letters, you know, like 12, whatever. And then he's like, then I told my friend to write her back or whatever. And he said, then I got the Dear John letter. And he's right. like, oh, that's terrible. He's like, oh, no, they're happily married and all that. So to me, that points to him losing the love of his life right there.
Right.
And maybe that's why he's all up into his work and why he is in love with this computer. I think that that's a very harsh reality for him at this point.
Right. And she accuses him of being in love with that computer. And I believe my feeling is in the movie in the beginning when they're up on the porch in the cold eating lunch and mm-hmm. they start that intelligent banter. I believe that's when the intrigue he was more intrigued with her than just this is business and I need to figure this out kind of a thing. But I agree with you gentlemen with where all this kind of falls into place. He keeps trying to give her more to drink up there and she keeps refusing because she, like you said, was trying to like kind of dig deeper. There were a few moments up there when you could actually feel that connection between the two. And even there was a moment when they finally stood up to leave.
Well, she stands up and she got a telephone call and she kind of right. then like, uh-oh, like this is going somewhere.
And right. Then,
I think it's a phone call from one of the other ladies and she's like, hey, guess what? Mike just right. got promoted to vice president or whatever.
Well, that was before. That was after they came down the street, right when they came down the circular stairs from the library upstairs, there was a moment where Sumner kind of looked at her and you could tell there was history there. I mean, you could tell like their natural history was, I mean, it was palpable, mm-hmm. but yeah, she goes down and she gets a phone call and Mike's got the vice presidency and be prepared. He's on his way up and yeah. he comes bounding up and
he comes down her elevator. Does he come down her elevator behind
he
her?
He comes in her door. Cause when you open yeah. the door, you can see there's a hallway and then the elevator. He comes in and they're trying to talk and the party's still going on and he's talking louder and louder and louder and louder and louder. And he's like, I can't, she's like, why are you shouting? He's like, I can't talk over you. The bongos. So he shuts the door and it was fun. Sumner playing the bongos.
Yeah, he's playing my bongos.
Yes. So, you know, there was a big congratulatory moment and he's talking about marriage and he was just about to ask her and then something pulls him away and he had to go. And she had that look of disappointment again.
Yeah, but I think this is when he comes back down and he says, look, she's like, oh, you're vice president.
He's
like,
yeah,
now, you know, I'm vice president of the West Coast. She's like, well, that's the first
yes. thing.
What do you mean West Coast?
Right.
Like, he's like, oh, this is wonderful. She's like, but I work here. He's like, oh, no, you're going to come with me. He said, we can buy this house. And she's like, well, what about the girls? He said,
yeah. Visit them once a year.
Yeah. And she's like, well, I couldn't do that. You know,
and then what about my job? And he's like, well, no, you'll be taking care of my house. You know, it wasn't stated that way, but it was stated
basically.
That way.
Basically. Yeah. And yeah.
And she's like, no.
Huh. And he's like, yeah. And you know, we can finally, you know, build a house together.
Right.
She's like, oh well, what about my apartment? She's like, he's like, well, you can find anybody to get in your apartment these days, the way it is here.
Right.
So,
right. And he did come up with the statement of, well, if you have to worry about your apartment or your job or things like that, then are you really ready to get married? You know,
yeah.
which is kind of where they were going with it anyways. But he said the quiet part aloud. So the party's calming down. It's just the four ladies and Sumner and they were having a good laugh. He was going to bring everybody to dinner and pay for it. So they were excited. And they all were standing, the three ladies were standing with their backs to Bonnie's office, looking to the door to get out of to leave the building. And in walks a very straight-laced, buttoned-up woman. And she's talking with Sumner, and he didn't understand who she was. And it was the computer programmer, the expert of MRAC, which is the computer program coming in to their office. So now all the girls now realize right before Christmas, okay, this is really going to happen and our world is not going to be the same. So the air is completely different. They're very sad. And Sumner's like, you know, this is not a good time. We'll have to talk later. And she leaves, you know, after she, you know, well, she remarks to where it's going to be and where the desks have to move and how things are going to have to change. And the girls are just standing there just really, you know. So throughout this movie, very sporadically spoken.
I think they realize now that he's here for something different than what. And he's like, can we not talk about this today? Not today of all days. Let's can we wait till tomorrow or next Monday or whatever. And this is where you see Katharine Hepburn just get really, really mad. And she gives one of the coldest Merry Christmases I've ever seen in my life. I was like, I was trying to think about when is the last time I saw have a Merry Christmas. You know, just I was like,
yes,
I don't know.
Yeah, and a very Merry Christmas to you. Yeah, it was like a very Merry Christmas to you too. And I'm like, whoa.
They've never been that memorable. So
now has she just not got into a big fight with Mike? Because she was like, you know, he's like, oh, you've been messing around for 7 years or whatever. And then he slams the door and she opens up. No, you waited for 7 years and slams the door.
Right.
To being happy, getting ready to go have drinks to now she's lost.
She lost Mike.
Yeah.
She's going to lose Sumner. Who she doesn't even have yet.
She doesn't even know what's going on. She's getting ready to lose her job too.
In her job with her girls.
Yep. So.
And
all this last moment.
right. So the next scene comes in. There's doors where they used to not be doors. There's no smoking signs everywhere because up until this point they were able to smoke in their office. Mind you, there was another little itty bitty line that was running through the whole movie that they had. He had another computer going into payroll.
Hey, Sarah,
so that was going to roll out at the same time. Yes, sir.
I think one thing we need to mention is as they're all sitting there on Christmas, the phone rings. And
she
says, yes, I can. And she starts reciting, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Yes, so she does.
I think that was really a special moment, too, because she knows she might not have that many more times left to answer these phones with this computer coming in.
Right. And prior to that, earlier in the day, they kept getting calls about the reindeer and they were complaining about it every year. They just don't know. And so every single one of them took the call at a different time. And then even Sumner picked up the phone at one point. He's like, oh, yeah, I can help you with that. It's like happy, sleepy, dopey. And he's like, he just had random names. It was hilarious. So in comes this. Now they've also been playing off the fact that payroll is going to be getting a computer as well, that they've already made some changes there and half the department has already been let go. So this is where they're gathering this fear that they're getting rid of staff. So, you know, you come in and half the stage is taken by this gigantic computer. I mean, it's a two-story computer on one side, a one-story big desk on the other. It's huge.
Just a complete eyesore.
Oh, my gosh. The buttoned-up lady, she's so uptight. You can feel it through the screen. A towel over her arm just to pick up anything. And she, you know, talks to it like, good girl, and pets it. and these girls from the reference department keep bringing her books. You know, here's the entire works of William Shakespeare and da-da-da-da-da. And she's coding all this information in. And one of the girls opens the door to go get something and the woman is yelling at her, oh, shut the door. She keeps doing that behind the girls. And then the other girl starts to light up a cigarette and she takes that cigarette and, you know, runs out off scene. And so there's a whole conversation about, you know, her, how tight she is and how Amarak is nothing but a problem. And
might get welcome pink slip because their job's so ruined.
Yes. Right. And, you know, they were having that conversation and in walks, they're like, you know, payroll's late today. It's never this late. And so they're all like, you know, for sure, we're getting a pink slip. And then they were talking about how quick it would be to start getting unemployment. I mean, they were covering all of these bases. And then in walks Sumner in walks the payroll. Yeah, no, Sumner with all
Sumner
the guys.
In, yeah, Sumner comes with all in the guys. With all the guys. Yeah.
Big wigs. And uptight girl comes back and they're, you know, they're like, all right, you know, let us see how this big machine works. And he asks Bunny, you know, the CEO, Bunny, has this machine helped you? And she goes, I don't quite know yet. We've just been spending the last 2 weeks feeding it information. It has yet to give us anything back. So they ask some questions, you know, and the woman very loudly through the old typewriters types it in. And this big printer with, you know, a foot and a half wide paper comes printing out. I'm like, what waste? But and then the answer was, you know, how many pounds does the earth weigh? And Bunny remembered the numbers. And the one girl, was it this question? The one girl said,
no, it was the question about the weight of all the wood, spruce wood trees, I believe, something like that.
Oh, what the
cost,
the spruce bud worm.
Spruce
worm,
yeah.
Yeah. How many acres of trees did it ruin? And the one girl goes, because Bunny asked the question to ask the machine. And the one girl
Bunny answers it. And they said,
she answers it.
She says, some odd cents. She couldn't remember the cents.
And it was like 12 cents. 12 cents. Yeah, she couldn't remember the cents.
Right.
But the girl, right before we get the answer, the girl whispers, it took us 3 weeks to find that. And it bumped out the answer. And as it's going, Sumner, or I think the boss says, do you remember, Bunny? And she says the exact number. And then she goes, and some cents. Well, it was 12 cents. So they kind of like, when he was reading off the answer from the computer, it's like he went, and 12 cents, you know, and she kind of took that as a slight.
How much better am I than you? 12 cents?
Right. Right. I mean, really, does 12 cents make a difference? Right.
So then those guys leave, and this is where the payroll boy comes in. And she's like, oh, the paychecks. And so they all hand them out.
Yes.
Like, and Bunny's like, ah, don't fret until we open them. You know, there's no need to fret.
they all pull out pink slips, every single one of them. So they all now, they all start going into Bunny's office, and one runs back to get boxes because they're going to have to pack up her office. And the philodendron comes into play again because they're like, how the heck are we going to get this package? He goes, I'll just tell the bus driver it's a person and pay an extra fare. So they start to take it down off the hooks and start to pack up her office. And then the phone rings. And what is her name? I want to call her Emily. The woman that's working with Emmerak, she was like looking for the girls, like answer the phone. And they didn't respond to her really. So she answers the phone and they ask about the king of the Watusis, what car he drives. And the girls overhear this. And so they remember their response, you know, their time when they looked up that. And they're like leaning against the doorway of Bunny's office, just watching this unfold. And she tries to type it in. Bunny corrects it. And as this woman's typing, they're all, the woman and the four girls are mouthing the spelling to the Watusis. It was great. Then another phone call comes and they're asking about curfew and not curfew. It was a play on words. And so in walks Sumner and she's like, oh, get that other phone. I couldn't do it. So craziness ensues. So the Watusi's information, Bunny said it's going to be wrong. And then the curfew thing, she typed in the wrong thing and Bunny knew it. So Bunny starts to delegate to her girls. All right, go over here, get this book. You go over here to get this book. You take that phone call. You take that phone call. And they all kind of separate. And Bunny walks over to the printer. And Sumner's starting to get upset because the girl's getting upset because what she's typing is not right. So Bunny's reading the wrong article about the King of the Watusis, the movie, not the king himself. And then all of a sudden, the 80 stanza poem of curfew comes up and very, very wrong, just with a lot of feeling and loud and passionate, Bunny starts reciting the poem. And Sumner and her are going back and forth. And as different things are being said, the stanza in that poem fits. So she starts to speak it again. And the woman starts losing her mind. And the red button that you couldn't pull on Emmerak got pulled.
Crazy.
And it hurt. And she had it in her hand. And the machine goes crazy. And I was watching this with earphones on. And boy, was that a surprise. And it's just spitting stuff and making boops and bee boops and all kinds of crap everywhere. And just it's insane. While all of this insanity comes in, Mike walks in with a dozen roses. So Bunny follows him and they have a little exchange. And basically through that exchange, they realize it's probably not going to happen. He's realizing she's not giving him what she used to. And then she goes back in the room to handle something, and it really is going crazy. So he's like, here, give me a hair pick, or give me something, a wire. So she grabs a hair pick from her hair and hands it to him, and he fixes it and it calms down. And this the worker, the computer professional, she's losing her mind. She's just like, you don't care about me. These people want me to fail. They've done nothing but make me try to fail. And she throws the red button that you had to pull to make it go crazy and storms out. And they're like kind of looking at her. And as this is, you know, happening, Mike is just kind of observing. And everybody leaves the office at that point.
Well, she
calmed down.
The one girl storms out. And right. This is where he gets the hair pick because it's still going crazy. It's smoking, shooting papers.
Right.
And did you hear what he does? Whatever he does, the computer's like goes, ah, like it sighs or something. I thought that was pretty funny.
That was good. Yeah, that is great. It had only the personality. But
she goes back into her office to talk to Mike right now, I do believe.
Right. And they talk. And then they kind of realize that. She's not going anywhere.
Sumner opens the door and says, can I see you a minute?
Calls her in.
Yeah.
And then he says, you know, this thing, let's ask it a question. And he types in, should Bunny marry Mike? And Bunny's like, well, wait a minute. I thought this couldn't, you know, figure out things. It had to be just, you know, black and white. And he goes, well, let's just see what it says. And he goes, well, go look. And she goes, I'm not going to go look because I know what the answer is. And then he types, well, should Bunny marry Sumner? And it said yes. So she goes, you know what? No, it's never going to work because you love this computer more than you love me. And you're not going to. You're not going to, you know, love me as much. And you're always going to put her first.
Right.
And
she goes down, you're always going to be there for her.
Right. And he goes, no. He says, that's not true. And she goes, all right, prove it to me. She pulls the red button again. And Emmerich goes nuts. I mean, completely nuts again, smoking, spitting cards out. And he's holding her and he stops. He goes, well, just give me a quick second. And he takes another wire from her hair and fixes it real quick. And then they like hold each other and look at the computer, and the back of the computer prints out the end. And then that's it.
I like how they're sitting there and they're fixing it. And Mike's opened the door and he's overheard everything that has just been said. Yeah. And he brings the flowers or whatever and sets it on the thing. He just walks out without even interrupting them or whatever.
No, I forgot that part. Yes. And also when the pink slip situation happened, I forgot to mention, it's a really funny part of the film. Everybody is getting pink slips. And the CEO calls Sumner. He needs to speak to him right now. I want to talk to you right now. He's like, why did I get a pink slip? And then the old lady, the little old lady that keeps showing up throughout the whole movie, even during the Christmas scene, went and took alcohol that was in the watering thing, but she came back in and ripped up her pink slip and threw it at Sumner and then walked back out. And so he had to borrow another hairpin from Bunny to go down to payroll to fix that machine too. It's a great movie. I was thinking last night while watching it, there's so many moving parts and there's so much subtlety that is missed during our conversation tonight, that I highly recommend going to watch it. Truly.
All right, so Sarah, so what we're going to do is we will start with you, and we want you to rate this on a 1 to 10 and tell us why. And then we will go to Kyle, and then I'll follow it up from Kyle. So let's hear what you say.
I would give it 9.5. I think the cinematography was very good. The lighting, coloring, everything was great. The acting was phenomenal. Not one character in this movie didn't add something to it. There was every single character really truly brought a part to the movie. And it's one of those perfect quintessential, no sad things, no scary stuff, no gory things. It was perfect. Loved it.
All right, Kyle.
Okay. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, actually, I muted myself a little bit earlier. I was going to try to interrupt you once, and then I realized, like, oh, they're not hearing me at all. Oh, and I thought, good. Really rude. And then I looked down and see a red light, and I'm like, oh, I'm muted because I'm silly. And realized it then. I was going to interrupt you when I said that they receive all the pink slips, which also, I guess, I think that lends itself to Sumner's kind of innocence and the fact that, like, he never intended to fire any of the women in that department. He purely meant the computer would be an additive thing to their lifestyle, and it's just all one misunderstanding, the idea that they would lose their jobs because of the computer. So Richard.
Yeah, because it was actually going to make more work. They were getting more people there.
Yeah, because they were going to get more people there. And like, yeah, it was going to be like their jobs were going to be even busier than ever. You know, so they needed.
Right. And the reason why he couldn't tell them is because they were trying to keep it quiet before the merger happened with the West Coast. Because if the word got out, then the stock would have gone up and it would have been too expensive to buy. So that was his reasoning for not telling the girls.
Exactly.
So what do you think, Kyle?
So of the overall film itself, you know, I probably would have been a little bit lower at the start of this podcast. We had the review, but going through all the details we kind of mentioned through here, I'm feeling a lot stronger about this film overall. So I think I'm more hovering around 7.5, where I feel like this film is pretty remarkable comfort food in many areas, where like, I don't feel like it's meant to, I don't think it's meant to like challenge you or make you like reinterpret a lot of things or break down the genre to do cool things like that too. But it is just very straightforward and earnest. And it's just kind of like wholesome, good romantic comedy fun and really gets the job done on that level. And it does it really, really tightly and masterfully. I think Katharine Hepburn's performance, Katharine Hepburn has a knack for doing every performance and making it look effortless. And this continues in this film entirely true. Spencer Tracy always puts in an A-level performance too, and all the other actors are doing a fantastic job as well. But of course, Spencer and Catherine just stand out so easily just because they make it look effortless, and no doubt they put a tremendous amount of effort in. So that's on them for that. And overall, this film is pretty darn good, verging on great for me going right here. I think even if I watched it more times, I'd probably appreciate it even more. But as it says, that's where I'm standing right now, at a strong 7.5, verging on 8, possibly going up in the future. I think it's a very strong film and thoroughly enjoyed it now. I feel a lot better about my time I spent with it, and I'll probably spend more time with it in the future. So that's good for me. So from that, I'll pivot over to Jimbo. Jimbo, what are your thoughts on the film?
All right. First and foremost, Die Hard is not a Christmas movie. Let's get that out of the way. All right.
I agree.
Here we go. Katharine Hepburn is probably one of the greatest actresses of all time. She's very well I don't want to say controlling, but she's very, all of her acting is, when she's acting, she's trying to make a point while she's acting with her facial expressions, her gestures, everything. When you add Spencer Tracy with her, it just even gets better because you can see how much that they respected each other and how they play off of each other. The one problem I have with this movie is the whole time, I don't think it dove into the emotional connection between him and her very much. It was like hey, we get drunk, we're going to talk about our feelings on Christmas Day, and that's it. You know, we say one thing about a letter. I would have liked to have a little bit more dialogue between him and her, you know, maybe even when they were at her house, when the bathrobes before Mike got there. Just something like maybe from her past. Why isn't she married? You know, what happened before Mike? What'd you do? Did you, like, especially when she asked him, well, don't you like girls? And he said, don't you like boys? You know, what's the difference? So I would have loved to see more dialogue there, but I had never watched this movie, and I've seen several Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn movies. So for that, I'm probably going to rank it an 8. It's definitely one that you need to watch, especially if you're a fan of the golden era of Hollywood. I'm talking Spencer Tracy, Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, Lucille Ball, all these Jerry Lewis, Dean Martin, all these actors from that time period, from the 50s to about the 70s, there is a lot of good movies in there that people often overlook, but they do need to be looked at least once. So yeah, it was a very good movie. And as I was telling Kyle before you got in here, it actually received 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, and that's something hard to do. So we thank you for suggesting this. It was fun. Before we get out of here though, I would like you to tell the audience about everything you're doing with Tim Mullins now and his new Studio 41 podcast. So they can follow him and maybe go check out Solo and stuff. So
yeah, it's fun. Tim Mullins has got an imagination like no other. We're all blessed to know him. We have done a show that is going to begin pretty soon. It's going to be rolled out pretty soon. We've recorded a few, and I believe one of them rolled out during your Christmas special called Intercede. And the backstory is it was a husband and wife who were murdered and were sent back to Earth by God to intervene in lives and help people in various situations. So that is a lot of fun. Pulls at the heartstrings, which Tim likes to do. So that's a good thing. But it's good to kind of play with the Christian end of things in an acting sense. The other thing that we are doing is Solo, a Zombie Apocalypse. The first two seasons are already out. You can look up Solo, a Zombie Apocalypse anywhere you get your podcasts at. And it started out with one man who thought he was the only one that survived the apocalypse. And as he goes through his travels, he finds he's not alone. And he picked up a woman named Bree in season two, who promptly kicked his butt. And that's how they met. And then he kicked her butt back and used her as bear bait. And then she almost died being attacked by a group of thugs. And then he brought her back to life. And that's where it ends this last season. So there's a lot in between there. I'm cutting out a ton of stuff. But it's a lot of fun to play a badass and have a good time and a muscle car junkie. So it's good. And next season we are working on it already. We've already got a few episodes printed. He's got a lot more, but we're getting ready to record pretty soon. So please check out the first two seasons, because it gets you into what's going to happen, because the storyline definitely feeds into one another.
Right. Well, you need to tell him he needs to change it from Solo to Duo now, because it's not longer a solo, it's a duo. But go check out some of his stuff and leave a review. Tim's been a really good friend of mine for a long time, stemming way back from when I first started listening to Hillbilly Horror Stories. And he helped a lot with this podcast initially. Mm-hmm. And if I ever have any questions about audio, hey, can you make this? Like if you ever listen to the Universal Monster series I did with my dad on here, he made the intro with that, with the bunch of like the old Universal Monster sounds with creaks and screams and mad scientists and stuff like that. So he's always willing to help. Right. He's supposed to be coming on this podcast to do the Never Ending Story, but Tim, I'm about to run Never Ending Time if you don't hurry up. So
that's a great movie.
He is building a house from basically gutting the whole thing and redoing it. So I'll cut him a little bit slack for a little bit more time until he gets his podcast room up studio. Then I'm going to be on him. So
I think he doesn't even have the walls up. And by the way, for those of you who might have known Hillbilly Horror House, which was his production studio, he's still friends with Jerry Pauly and Tracy, but he wanted to have something that kind of stood alone and didn't play off of their name, because he wanted to respect them. So he's changing his production company name to 41 Productions, which has a really deep meaning for him. So 41 Productions, it'll be flopped over. And you can also check out Solo Zombie Apocalypse Facebook page. We have a lot of fun over there. So
does he have a website?
I don't
remember.
Think so. I knew you were going to ask me a question. I didn't know the name.
Exactly. I have an acronym, I swear.
I know. I mean, thanks, James. Okay. No, I don't know.
You can post it into our Facebook page.
Facebook group. And
you're part of it. So if you want to post it in there, that's fine.
Of course.
If you like what you heard, we are the Tragedy of Cinema podcast. I'm Jimbo. He's Kyle. She's Sarah from the 41 Studio Productions. And Tim Mullins, who's absent tonight. Go give them a listen. Leave them a review. If you'd like to leave us a review, we will read it on the air, good, bad, or Kyle, as I like to say.
Hey,
and you think Kyle butchered names tonight, and that wording is hard. The Godzilla episode we did, the original,
was all Japanese.
And Kyle,
I missed that one.
I'm going to let you know, Bond, our faithful listener of the Twilight Zone, and left us a review. He's half Japanese. So we've been talking on Facebook, and I said, oh boy, I said, don't hate us too much. I said, because we tried, and I put out a warning saying, look, we're going to do our best, but we are who we are. You know, so
we are two butchers of men.
He's going to be joining Eric and I for a Quality of Mercy episode on Twilight Zone that has some Japanese names. And he already messaged me back once that said, hey, by the way, one of the Japanese names in here is his mother's maiden name. So I thought that was really cool.
That's cool. That.
Yeah. So,
yeah, you just have to have him come on and like say the names and record them for you. So you just play that section or write them out phonetically. Because names are hard.
He's already put in his application to replace Kyle.
Kyle, are you going somewhere?
No.
Not to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, anyways. But some days maybe I'll just give him the job.
Yeah, because I could pick on Kyle. Bond might beat me up.
Exactly. He needs someone to draw
because,
around.
Because, you know, he's Bond. Jason Bond. Don't forget. So if you'd like to reach out to us, we are thetragedyofcinema@gmail.com. You can join us on our Facebook page, The Tragedy of Cinema Podcast. We have merchandise for sale. I'm wearing my Twilight Zone shirt today. We have several, I think, five different designs on there. We are having a live show at the Boone County Jail and Distillery. October 26th, we will be showing, we've started to finalize some of the stuff. We will be showing the Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Charlie Brown's Halloween, the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown for the kids before the trick-or-treat. Then we're doing the trick-or-treat around the town square. And then we're going to come back and we're going to probably show two of the old Universal Monster movies there at the jail with Jackie Johnson and them. So go ahead and mark your calendars. And we're not charging anything for this. It's a free event. But all we're asking is that you bring a can donation or a non-perishable thing. Jackie's going to get me a list. They said she's going to check with the Heart of Lebanon, see what they need, what we can bring. Or she said we may go to an animal shelter there. So it's going to depend on which one she gets. So it's nothing.
Terrible causes.
Yeah. So, with that being said, I think this episode's coming to a close, and that's a wrap.
And clap. Yeah. Get it. Yeah.